In a world in which movies struggle to find plot, Alan Adams of The Main Edge breaks it down for you in Pass the Popcorn. Now on Downtown with Rich Kimball.
Let's all go to the lobby.
Yes, indeed. Time Let's to talk movies. It's Pass the Popcorn. Alan Adams of The Main Edge joining us. Look, it's all a letdown talking to us or anything else after you've been at Cherryfield Days. Hello there, Alan.
Hello, how are you?
Wonderful. How was your weekend?
It was good. It was good. Yeah, we took a quick spin down east, visited with the in-laws, and had the opportunity to go to the world-famous Cherryfield Days Parade. We took Stella. It was something that maybe we didn't consider as fully as we ought to have. Turns out at parades, a lot of big trucks made a lot of noise.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And Miss Stella wasn't necessarily super jazzed about that. But once the horses turned up, she was all attention because I don't know if you knew this about Stella, loves horses. It's a weird thing, but yeah, she's fascinated by them.
Well, I saw the picture and she genuinely seemed to be captivated.
Yeah, no, she was very interested in seeing what the horses were about. Sheridan and I posited that she thinks they're just really big dogs, but we don't know, obviously, because Stella is a dog and can't speak English, so we can't know for certain. And so we're comfortable just assuming that it's because she views them as large dogs that she hopes to become friends with.
Well, you know, any respectable horse would want to be friends with Stella from my perspective.
Right. That just seems to make sense. I mean, I don't want to speak for all the horses in the world, but, what's the holdup?
No question about that. Well, you also saw a whole lot of movies since we talked with you last, four of them on the agenda. Where do you want to begin?
We'll start with the ones that, aren't necessarily that interesting.
Okay.
The first one we'll talk about is it's a movie called Good on Paper. It is the latest in the long stream of, I assume, algorithmically generated romantic comedies from Netflix. It's directed by a woman named Kimmy Gatewood. The script was written by Eliza Schlesinger, who also stars. And it's ostensibly based on true events from Schlesinger's life, a clear effort to find sort of a darker angle on the traditional romantic comedy. It is not a successful effort, but it is an effort, largely because it doesn't really seem to want to settle on what kind of movie it wants to be. And honestly, the reality is, like, if it had committed in going more fully in either direction, either really leaning into the dark aspect of things or just maintaining as a traditional, more traditional romantic comedy, it would have been a better movie either way. Instead, we get something that's very muddy and that feels kind of like perhaps potential is squandered. The basic gist is Schlesinger plays Andrea Singer, a stand-up comedian. Who has been working, trying to make it in L.A. for like 10 years. Small gains here and there, but mostly she's spinning her wheels, both professionally and personally. And she feels like she needs a change. And that change appears with a chance meeting on a plane. She meets a man named Dennis, played by Ryan Hansen. Completely different from her usual type, kind of a nerd, a little awkward. He's a Yale grad and he's a hedge fund manager. But he just seems to want to make her happy. Initially, they start off as friends, but slowly he wins her over and they start dating. And at first, everything's great. But as the relationship progresses, she starts to have some questions about Dennis. Like, so much about him seems too good to be true, so what if it actually is too good to be true? And his parts of his story start to fall apart when they're scrutinized, even a little bit. So Andrea and her friends are sort of exploring further. The more she digs, the more she learns, the more questions she has. And she's wondering just who this guy really is. And if that person is someone that she actually wants to be. At the risk of sounding glib, you know, good on paper is one of those ideas that sounds good on paper. You know, the idea of injecting a degree of mystery and intrigue into that sort of standard rom-com formula, that's interesting. Like, and we've certainly seen success in the past with movies that have kind of folded other genre concepts into that sort of rom-com mix. But it doesn't work here. And it's the big issue is, and I mentioned before, they just they don't commit to the bit. Rather than leaning into those the more shadowy aspects of this concept, they just kind of wander around the edges. We get some hints at the more interesting movie this could have been, but for the most part, we're just very, very small, never plumbing the depths. And again, I don't know that it would have worked. It's tough to say, but at least that would have felt like a genuine effort rather than the sort of middling, muddy thing that we get here. And you can kind of watch, you kind of see it break down when you watch it. First act's pretty standard rom-com. Things start to deteriorate, but they never really deteriorate to the degree that they would need to make this movie the what it ultimately aspires to be. There's stuff to like, you know. There's some good chemistry between the leads, but the movie never really takes advantage. The supporting cast is pretty okay, but it's basically a two-hander. They do their best, but it's not enough to clarify everything. So yeah, essentially. It earns its title. It's a decent idea whose execution doesn't measure up.
All right. That's the story on Good on Paper. What's next?
Next, we'll talk about False Positive, which is a movie that dropped on Hulu this weekend. I actually had kind of high hopes for this one. It's sort of in that sort of underdeveloped but always pretty freaky sort of subgenre of like baby horror, there's so many mysteries that come with pregnancy and giving birth that, you know, it allows a lot of leeway, especially with a horror movie. You do demonic possession, like supernatural rituals, weird science. Plus you have the whole body horror underpinning, that kind of comes with the whole situation. And so I'm like, okay, let's do this. It's got an interesting, collection of talent. Alana Glazier stars. She co-wrote the script alongside the director, John Lee. They both have some really weird credits to their respective names. Co-stars, you've got Justin Theroux, who's always good. Pierce Brosnan is in this movie. Like, you've got my attention. But while the movie does start with some promise, it's another example of a movie that never quite gets to where we want it to be. Instead, we have this sort of mishmash of dream sequences and what is real psychodrama that never really finds its footing. Like, so many of the decisions made by everyone in this movie make little or no sense. Like, you don't know why people are doing what they're doing. And so we wind up with this confusing and ultimately unsatisfying movie that, again, has some moments of strength, but not nearly enough. The basic gist is Lucy, played by Glazier, and her husband Adrian, played by Theroux, have been trying to conceive for quite some time. Years of frustration, they finally decide to consult with a specialist. Conveniently enough, Adrian's old med school professor, Dr. John Hindle, that's Pierce Brosnan, is one of the world's foremost fertility doctors. He's got a celebrated clinic, years-long waiting list, but they can jump the line because, her husband is old friends with the doctor. He quickly comes up with some solutions. Before you know it, he's offered up his own special secret method to make pregnancy happen. And suddenly, just like that, it works. She's pregnant, to the delight of both her and her husband. But it's not long before we start to wonder, and she starts to have some misgivings about the whole process. She's uncomfortable with the dynamic between her husband and his old mentor, the doctor's staff, particularly the lead nurse, Dawn, who's played by the wonderful Gretchen Mol, makes her uncomfortable. You know, she's getting mixed messages at work. She's not sure what to make of the various mommy friends that she's been making. And the circumstances surrounding the pregnancy leave her with some difficult choices that may or may not will be what she ultimately wants. All this, plus she's seeing and hearing things that may not be real, like all these nightmarish images and hallucinatory moments, and it's like, can this be chalked up to the extremity of the pregnancy, or is there something darker afoot? Spoiler alert, there's something darker afoot.
Ooh, who saw that coming?
Look, man, the movie's a bit of a mess. Like, it's very inconsistent, that makes it tough to fully invest. Like, even when you leave aside how, frankly, derivative it feels in spots, if that description made you think about something like Rosemary's Baby, I don't believe that's an accident. Like, I think that's a very deliberate effort by the filmmakers. And again, there are some bits that absolutely do work, but they're surrounded by extended stretches that just don't make any sense. Again, it works best when it leans into that sort of body horror aspect. Like, it's funny because you could tell that both the director, John Lee, and Alana Glazier, they find that aspect of things really fascinating. And that's when we start to see, the real potential of this movie, something really unsettling and powerful and weird. But then, you know, they always sort of go back into this sort of the quasi-generic thriller vibe that uses Lucy's questionable mental state as a crutch. they go to that well a few too many times, I guess, sort of relying on her unreliability. Like I said, high aspirations, and it genuinely tries to reach those heights. It just doesn't get there. It's jagged, and all that jaggedness kind of undermines the slickness of the scares it clearly wants to produce. And you're sitting there, and you're just sort of feeling like you've kind of seen it all before. Again, solid performances, just what you'd expect from some real pros. Glazer's good. Thoreau's got a really weird knack for eliciting empathetic responses to off-putting people, and he uses it wisely here. And man, Pierce Brosnan is just 100% total creepster in this. Like, he's big and broad. There's a little whiff of ham about this performance, but it's fun to watch. And the rest of the cast feels vaguely overqualified. I guess it's one of those things where it's a movie that knew where it wanted to be, but didn't make the right choices to get there. It just ultimately doesn't deliver.
All right, that's the story on a positive. Alan Adams from The Main Edge talking movies with us here on Downtown. What's number three?
Okay, so we're going to talk about The Ice Road. Now, this is another Netflix film. And we've talked about this on a number of occasions. The fact that I have a real and genuine affection for the old man action movie.
Mm.
I just find it very compelling about, you know, watching a creaky-kneed old guy just sort of hobble his way across the screen, gratefully giving way to stunt performers when things get a little too active. that probably sounds derogatory.
I embrace that.
But it doesn't change the fact that I do for real dig it. And the king of, I don't know if this term has been coined before, but I'm gonna drop it right here. The king of Jerry action.
Oh, very nice.
Pretty good, right?
I like that.
Don't forget about that one.
That's why you're on Rotten Tomatoes.
The king is my man Liam Neeson. Like, the Taken franchise really kicked off the boom times of this particular subgenre. But I think it's worth noting, I don't think aging action stars who got old, I don't think that counts. So like Schwarzenegger and Stallone, Bruce Willis, like I don't count those guys. But here's the thing. Neeson, while he has definitely lost a step since that first Taken outing, which is like 15 years old at this point, he's still getting after it. His latest foray is The Ice Road, written and directed by a guy named Jonathan Hensley. And this time, Neeson is an over-the-road truck driver pressed into service to save a bunch of trapped miners before it's too late. Only there are outside forces conspiring to stop him from doing that.
Ooh.
It's the sort of paint-by-numbers action thriller that basically makes up the entirety of Liam Neeson's workload these days. But it is an action thriller that is, frankly, lacking in both action and thrills. He does his gruff everyman thing with his vaguely kind of sort of American accent, you know, trying to convey world weariness, even as his only real motivation is clearly cashing his check. Like, this is a disposable movie, a movie designed for folks of a certain age to fall asleep in front of. the plot, as such as it is, methane explosion in a mine in Manitoba, 26 miners are trapped underground. For them to be rescued, the mining company must bring in some specialized drilling equipment, but the only way to get it to the location is via truck. The miners are trapped underground, air is running out, time is of the essence. Meanwhile, Mike McCann, that's Liam Neeson, and his brother have just gotten fired. They're looking for a new gig. Word gets out that Ice Road trucking legend Jim Goldenrod, played by Lawrence Fishburne, by the way, who is in this movie, is looking for drivers for this emergency run. Mike and his brother show up. They get hired, along with a couple of other drivers. They're each going to drive a truck carrying the necessary equipment for the rescue. However, the ice road they'll be driving is already 5 weeks past its usual shutdown date, so there's a good chance they won't all make it. That's why they've built in this redundancy. They've also brought along for the ride a guy named Barney, played by Benjamin Walker, who's an actuary for the insurance company. We move back and forth. We see sequences of the miners as they're struggling, and as often happens in these sorts of melodramatic things, factions develop where one group has questions about the circumstances behind the explosion. The other group is just looking to extend the air limit by quote unquote thinning out some of the more badly injured miners. And then it's basically just Liam Neeson and some other folks driving trucks on lakes. I don't know if you knew this, giant frozen lake, not particularly interesting to look at. And so it's just a lot of time spent in cabs of trucks driving. But then trucks start breaking down, breaking through the ice. People are getting hurt. People are dying. And wouldn't you know it, Rich, some of the people aren't telling the whole truth about who they are or what their interest in the situation might be.
Curse them.
And so our man Liam Neeson finds himself in a race against time, but also in a battle for his survival in the face of forces far more reaching and sinister than he ever could have anticipated. Look, it's exactly what you think it is. Like, you can hear the elevator pitch. Like, Liam Neeson drives a semi across an ice road to save miners and pretty much work out how it's all going to go. Like, there are no surprises. Even the moments that are meant to be twists are telegraphed, like, so far in advance that they almost become surprises again. again, like I said, there's not a lot of excitement that comes with basically driving in a straight line across a seemingly endless sheet of ice. Like, the ice cracks sometimes. There's some drama, such as it is. But there are long stretches of this movie that are very dull. Let's be clear, it's pretty obvious that Neeson could not give less of a crap about any of this. Like, his complete disinterest in anything going on around him, it borders on admirable. Like, he knows exactly what this movie is and what his contribution to it needs to be, and he gives precisely that much and not one iota more. Like, it's the usual stick. And the rest of the supporting cast, they're fine. Like, it's, you know, there are a couple of decent actors in there. There are a couple of that guy types. I'm guessing Lawrence Fishburne owed somebody a favor. But it's the kind of movie that you've already forgotten about before the credits are finished rolling. Like, I refer to it as a ASMR for retired dudes.
I like it. All right, well, let's go to another type of action movie, number 9 in the Fast and Furious franchise, F9.
Man, okay, so... My feelings about this movie are somewhat complicated, probably more complicated than the plot of the movie. First off, I don't want to be accused of burying the lead, so I'm just going to say this up front. F9 is a big, loud bunch of hot nonsense. Like, the plot is thin and peppered with holes at best, utterly incoherent at worst. The performances are winking and cartoonish. The action sequences gleefully defy even the most basic understanding of how physics work. Like, it is bright, candy-colored chaos, littered with CGI explosions and one-liners of varying effectiveness. And, Rich, I enjoyed myself very much. Like, I love well-crafted, sophisticated filmmaking as much as the next guy. Complex characters working through engaging narratives, every word and deed sporting some sort of discernible motivation. But that does not mean I cannot also find joy within the confines of the car chase cash register that is the Fast and Furious franchise. So this latest installment continues the ever increasing lunacy that's marked the series for years now. Like, you don't need me to point out the bizarreness of this little film about street racing developing into a blockbuster monolith packed with action and espionage and an ongoing cavalcade of movie stars. But it's hard to write about these movies without at least acknowledging that. For instance, the director of this one, Justin Lin, who basically made his name by directing entries 3 through 6 in this franchise, is back for this one. And as I said, I cannot in good conscience tell you that this movie is good, because it is not. However, there is no denying that it is great fun to watch. You've probably heard films described as something where you just need to turn your brain off. Like, get ready to flip that switch, because... like, you're gonna laugh and you're gonna shake your head at the physically impossible set pieces or the wildly improbable twists in the narrative. Like, there's a lot here that feels not just incoherent but almost willfully stupid. But there's just something about it, you know. Like, I'm not gonna go into too much detail on the plot such as it is. I will say we do open with a flashback to 1989, which is the time we will revisit periodically through this movie. We see the tragic racetrack death of Jack Toretto, who is the father to everyone's favorite street racer turned elite world-saving mercenary Dominic Toretto. And Dominic's never-before-seen or even mentioned before brother Jacob. The two brothers fall out in the aftermath of their father's death, which totally explains why literally no one has ever mentioned this brother before. In the present day, the aforementioned Dom Toretto, played by Vin Diesel, and his lady friend Letty, played by Michelle Rodriguez, are living in isolation with Dom's young son, who we met in the previous movie. They've gotten out of the game, you see. Only have they, Rich? Here's the thing. No one's ever out of the game in these movies. Before you know it, their old friends, Roman, Tej, and Ramsey, played by Tyrese Gibson, Ludacris, and Natalie Emanuel, respectively, turn up to tell them that the world needs them. Again. Their former handler, Mr. Nobody, played in a very brief cameo by Kurt Russell, has sent a distress message. He captured notorious hacker Cypher, Charlize Theron, who we met in a previous film, was transporting her, along with a mysterious and powerful device called Ares that can hack any computerized weapon system or something. It wasn't really clear. Planes hijacked, taken down. So the team gets back together. Dom's sister, Jordana Brewster, joins in. Oh, and it turns out that that Han, played by Sun Kang, he's been alive the whole time. Like we thought he died like several movies ago, but it turns out he's been alive the whole time and working for this Mr. Nobody. And it turns out that the previously mentioned but never before mentioned brother Jacob, played by John Cena, is now also an elite secret agent type guy, only on the bad guy's side. He's got a weirdo billionaire backing him, and he's trying to get his hand on this Ares thing, and will stop at nothing to get it. I'm going to stop now. I'm going to stop with this, because there's a ton more nonsense that happens here. Like, they've crammed a lot into the, like, 135 or so minutes that we have in this movie. But parsing it out, it's a fool's errand. Like, look, Rich, I haven't even gotten to the rocket car team, because it's rocket car team. I haven't gotten to the scene where Helen Mirren shows up. I haven't gotten any of it. Just know that it starts out not making sense and somehow manages to continue making less sense as you go along. And I say this, it's the logical continuation of what the franchise has been thus far. Like, the entire ethos of this series appears to be unchecked growth. So of course things are going to get bigger and broader and more insane. Like, there are set pieces in this film, like gun battles and car chases and fist fights, whatever, that simply defy all rational explanation. We're talking about a scoffing disregard for physical laws in seemingly every frame of film. I don't spoil it in the review, but I can mention it because I've seen it featured in a number of trailers. It's been an ongoing joke for the past few entries in this franchise. It's like, when are they going to go to space? Rich, the answer is F9. They go to space in F9.
Nice.
And again, you got to look. The spectacle is why we're here. And in that regard, this movie delivers. You gotta really embrace your suspension of disbelief, because everything that happens is impossible. But if you can do that, you'll be sitting pretty. Like, it is huge, it is dumb, it is hugely dumb, but it is also 2+ hours of popcorn-munching escapist fun. Like I said, on the narrative side, don't think too hard, or at all. Like, if you tug on even one thread, it all falls apart. I should note, there is one bit that's actually quite fun, where one of the characters seems to be on the verge of some kind of meta-awareness regarding the franchise as a whole and the fact that they are characters in a movie. Like, it's clumsy and it's incomplete, but it still might be the smartest the series has been in, like, 10 years. Performances, whatever. Vin Diesel has shockingly little dialogue for someone who's the lead. Doesn't say a lot. Basically just sort of silently glistens and glowers at whoever's actually advancing the plot. The rest of the ensemble, they do what they're asked to do. The standard crew, clearly comfortable with their roles, though no one appears to be trying all that hard. John Cena continues along his B+ The Rock path, which definitely works here. Charlize Theron, she's only in a couple of scenes. She obviously loves this stuff and is having a great time. Ditto Helen Mirren, who is just a delight. And like, it's basically an extended cameo, but she's just delightful. She basically steals a necklace and then gives Dominic Toretto a ride somewhere. But again, the performances, they don't matter. They're here because someone needs to drive the cars and pull the triggers and throw the punches and make the stupid speeches. There will always be people who believe that F9 and films like it embody what's wrong with the current cinematic landscape. And they have a point. But the truth is that for many people, going to the movies is all about escaping from reality for a couple of hours. And this movie is very much removed from reality. Yeah, it's loud and stupid, but sometimes, man, loud and stupid is all you want.
It's summer, right?
Exactly.
Embrace it. And, you know, maybe in the midst of it, you begin to think, that horse might just be a really big dog. All comes around, Alan.
Oh, it sure does.
You have a good couple of days. Let's visit again Wednesday if that works.
That sounds like a pretty good idea.
All right, we'll catch you then. Stay cool.
All right, you too, brother.
Thanks, Alan. Alan Adams, Main Edge. Talking movies on Downtown Past the Popcorn.